A media report suggests that the United States has hidden the killing of scores of women and children in airstrikes carried out in Syria. Saudi warplanes launch an airstrike on the Yemeni province of Shabwa, killing at least four civilians. And Sudanese security forces kill at least five demonstrators in a crackdown on anti-coup protests. A media report suggests that the United States has hidden the killing of scores of women and children in airstrikes carried out in Syria. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the issue with our guests. Let's hear their thoughts on this revelation. The United States has reportedly covered up the killing of at least 64 women and children in airstrikes it carried out 3 years ago on Syria's Deir ez-Zor province. The U.S. military maintains that two back-to-back strikes conducted on March the 18th, 2019, near the town of Bawruz killed 80 people, including 16 Daesh terrorists. That is while it admits it's unclear if the rest were civilians, arguing that the women and children could have been combatants. According to a New York Times report, a U.S. Air Force lawyer who oversaw the operation believed he had witnessed war crimes and notified the authorities. The Pentagon later launched an investigation into the strikes. But the Times says the subsequent report was, quote, stripped of any mention of the bombing. Well, joining me now on this edition of News Review is David Yahubian. He is a professor in the history department at California State University in San Bernardino, and Sarah Flounders. She is the co-director of International Action Center, joining us from New York. Thank you both for joining this edition of News Review. Let me just first start with Professor Yahubian. The U.S. has covered up the killing of about 70 civilians in Syria in 2019. As a professor of history, what is your reaction to this story?
Honestly, my reaction is that no one should be surprised by this at all. The world just watched as the United States slaughtered 10 family members in Kabul, seven of them being children, claiming that it was a righteous retribution against ISIS targets, basically, you know, ISIS-K, when in fact that intelligence wasn't there. They completely lied about the fact that there were no secondary explosions. And then perhaps most importantly, as we just found out about a week and a half ago, there will be absolutely no accountability. Furthermore, Daniel Hale, the former U.S. Air Force intelligence analyst who worked with the NSA, who worked with JSOC, is now going to be spending the next 45 months in prison for having let the world know that 90% of the victims of U.S. airstrikes are innocent bystanders, basically civilians. And so, in short, this is how the outlaw U.S. empire rolls. When civilians are slaughtered in its illegal occupations and wars abroad, the U.S. military will, by design, lie about it. They will cook the books. As we saw, Task Force 9 in this case was tasked with doing its own investigation, which, of course, it found that there was no culpability. And then subsequently, the site was literally bulldozed with the dead bodies of the civilian victims underneath. And so this is again, how the U.S. empire operates. This is standard MO. And I'll just add that the article seems to go to pains to describe how upper-level political elites were left out of the information loop, and therefore suggesting that somehow had they found out that they might have done something about it. In fact, again, this is why Chelsea Manning was tortured by the U.S. government. This is why Julian Assange is still undergoing torture and imprisonment for letting the public the world community know about these war crimes, about these atrocities. It is by design that American political elites are not informed about such atrocities, because if they are informed and it becomes public, then they're going to actually have to do something about it, at least some form of lip service. So again, this is standard MO for the U.S. empire.
Thank you so much. Let me just cross over to New York. Ms. Flounders, let me just read a short part of the report on the New York Times. It reads, "Who dropped that bomb? A confused analyst typed on a secure chat system being used by those monitoring the drone. Two people who reviewed the chat log recalled. Another responded, 'We just dropped on 50 women and children.'" Now, killing civilians is itself a horrendous crime under whatever pretext, and covering it up is just even more disconcerting and even more abhorrent. How do you comment on this?
Well, the first thing I would say is every aspect of the U.S. war in Syria was completely illegal. U.S. forces were never invited into Syria, so the thousands, literally thousands of bombing runs and drone attacks and arming of different forces on the ground were all completely illegal. And the war itself and who was fighting, all of this was completely an effort to pull apart from every angle and possibility the Syrian government. And even the New York Times article, while giving somewhat of an expose on this one attack where 70 civilians, women and children, hiding on the on a riverbank, the overhang of the riverbank, huddled, you know, were literally blown apart. That's one part of the expose. But the article claims that they were there in support of the Syrian Democratic Forces. Now, that entire force was a U.S. creation cobbled together to justify their involvement of mercenaries and all kinds of militia. So it's part of the illegal war on Syria. It was part of the effort to do as much destruction as possible, including bombing Raqqa to rubble, literally. How many civilians died in that?
Thank you so much, both of you. Thank you for joining me in this edition of News Review. I've been talking to David Yahubian. He's a professor of history at CSU, joining us from San Bernardino, and Sarah Flounders. She's the co-director of International Action Center, joining us from New York. Four more civilians have been killed in a fresh Saudi airstrike in Yemen's southern province of Shabwa. The deaths occurred when Saudi warplanes targeted a vehicle in the district of Mirk al-Ulia. This comes one day after four civilians were killed in another Saudi airstrike in Yemen's western province of Hodeidah. There were three children among the victims. The strike followed major advances made by Yemeni armed forces against foreign-backed militants in Hodeidah. Abdulatif al-Washili says the international community has been turning a blind eye to Saudi Arabia's continued aggression against the Yemeni people.
Shabwa is an eastern province of Yemen. It has got targeted so many times, especially after the advancements of the Yemeni army in these areas, especially Mirk al-Ulia. I believe this area was targeted about 2 weeks ago. This targeting is an absolute violation of the international law that protects civilians during wars. The Saudi warplanes killed yesterday four civilians, including three children, in a clear violation of Stockholm Agreement that prohibited waging any military actions against the Hodeidah province, the coastal province in western Yemen. Saudi Arabia has been killing Yemenis for 7 years now, so it's not anything, but the international community keeps turning a blind eye to the continued violations, to the continued crimes of Saudi Arabia. If the Yemeni army targeted a military camp or an airport used for military purposes inside Saudi Arabia, we see the Security Council of the United Nations condemning the attacks of the Yemeni army. But when it comes to Yemenis, they just keep remaining silent, even if the targetings are against civilians.
Anti-coup protests in Sudan have once again turned deadly after security forces violently clashed with demonstrators. Medics say at least 5 protesters were killed and several others injured. Police used live rounds and tear gas to disperse the protesters in the capital Khartoum and its twin city of Omdurman. People hit the streets to condemn a new ruling council introduced by the military that lacks civilian leaders. Coup leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan announced the formation of the council on Thursday and named himself as its head. The military seized power late last month, arresting dozens of government officials, including the prime minister. At least 16 people have been killed during protests since the coup. Political commentator Julius Sambaluto believes the Sudanese military is determined to stay in power, but will eventually submit to the will of the people.
The military seems keen and determined to go ahead against the wishes of the Sudanese, against the wishes of a lot of people across the world. Of course, we've seen protests everywhere. Now, with their determination, then also civilians and, of course, Sudanese are also determined. Remember, right now, the protest is in the hands of the people who are key to send Omar Bashir home. And this is the Sudanese Professional Association, also with the resistance committee. These two are key, and now they're in the mainstream of the protest. And we are talking about now 1 million march, so it's not just a few people. So from my understanding, it's the beginnings of a major conflict now between the military and the protesters, of course. And of course, we are sadly enough, you have some military being supported maybe by some quarters somewhere, but that kind of giving them illusion that they can carry on, and also with the protesters, I don't see them stopping. I see them going all the way.
At least 6 people are reportedly killed and several others wounded in a bomb attack on a Shia majority area near the Afghan capital Kabul. The incident took place after a magnetic bomb attached to a minibus detonated near a Taliban checkpoint in the Dasht-e Bagchi neighborhood. One of the victims was a well-known Afghan journalist. Afghanistan has witnessed a spate of terrorist attacks since the Taliban took control of the country in mid-August. On Friday, a bomb blast targeted a mosque in eastern province of Nangarhar, leaving at least 3 people dead and 15 others injured. More than 120 people were killed in Daesh-claimed bomb attacks on 2 Shia mosques in October. An Afghan family that has lost 10 members, including 7 children, in a U.S. drone strike in Kabul says it is still seeking justice and has yet to hear from the U.S. officials more than 2 months after the tragic event. Rahmatullah Bakhwan reports from Kabul.
These are the graves of 10 innocent family members who were killed by a U.S. drone strike on a home in Kabul. After the attack, the Pentagon apologized for the mistake and said the U.S. is considering making payments to the family of the victims and will get them out of Afghanistan. But it seems Washington has been indifferent to these promises as the family still awaits justice.
The attack was very horrific to our family. It martyred 10 of our loved ones and shocked those who have survived. When our relatives come here, it hurts them as they remember those innocent children martyred here. Of course, the U.S. should be held accountable.
Justice should be done to us. They promised that those responsible would be tried in a court, compensation would be paid, and they would take us out of Afghanistan. After their announcement, they have done nothing. They must stay true to their commitments.
Afghans and U.S. war survivors have repeatedly asked for meaningful transparency and accountability for the U.S. killings of their loved ones, but they have not received it from Washington so far.
The U.S. has always lied to these people. They make promises but don't fulfill them. For instance, see Ajmal's family that were decimated by the U.S. All of those killed were innocent. It has been 3 months that their relatives are left helpless.
People also believe that during its invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. military has always killed civilians, lied about it, and finally exonerated themselves. More than 2 months after this tragic attack, the U.S. has not taken any practical steps to reach out to the victims' family or pay compensation to them. and the survivors are still awaiting justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Negotiators at the COP26 talks in Glasgow reach a compromise on how to curb climate change despite disputes over the agreement's efficacy.
The approved texts are a compromise. They reflect the interests, the conditions, the contradictions, and the state of political will in the world today. They take important steps, but unfortunately, the collective political will was not enough to overcome such deep contradictions. As I
said, the UN chief said the world is still on the precipice of catastrophe. The agreement saw a last-minute change that some officials called a watering down of crucial language about thorny issues, including coal emissions. Several countries expressed deep disappointment at the change to phase down rather than phase out coal power, while the deal does not set a quota or timetable for countries' emission cuts. It also leaves many developing countries far short of the funds they need to build cleaner energy and cope with weather disasters. The deal came after 2 weeks of negotiations aimed at averting a global temperature rise of about 1.5 degrees Celsius. Thousands of Australians have attended a rally in the city of Melbourne to protest against mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations and the state government's proposed pandemic laws. The protest was reported to be peaceful, but slogans were chanted comparing the state government to Nazis, with some calling for violence against politicians. In Australia, where vaccinations are voluntary, 83% of people above 16 have been fully inoculated against the coronavirus. However, states and territories have mandated vaccinations for many occupations and barred the unvaccinated ones from activities such as dining out. Victoria, the second most populous state, has put such vaccination mandates into effect on Saturday. Protesters also rallied against the state government's proposed pandemic bill, which gives the state health minister power to restrict activities and movement.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In California, the state's insurance department's most recent data showed non-renewals of homeowners' insurance policies rose 31% from a year earlier in 2019 to more than 235,000. We are prepared for you an article written by David Shepherdson. The piece is titled Risky Business: Climate Change Turns Up the Heat on U.S. Insurers' Policyholders. Tony and Jahan Dunn never thought they would leave California, where they grew up, built a life together, and planned to retire. But after a wildfire swept through their Northern California town of Paradise 3 years ago, burning their home to the ground, they could not get insurance to buy another. Dunn, a retired planning specialist, told Reuters news agency from the couple's new home in North Carolina, "We basically got priced out of California." There are thousands of homeowners and businesses from California to Australia in a similar position because the insurance industry, known for its readiness to cover anything from Bruce Springsteen's vocal cords to alien abductions, has trouble factoring in climate change. Industry experts say the tried and tested approach, where decades worth of historical data serve to estimate future claims, falls short when weather patterns change and hurricanes, floods, heat waves, and snowstorms become more extreme and unpredictable. And the British host of the United Nations Climate Conference in Glasgow acknowledged on Wednesday, 10th of November, that current pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions were not enough to avert climate catastrophe. Insurance brokers AON said in a report recently that highly anomalous floods in Germany and China this year caused record insured losses in those regions. Attila Toff, chief executive at specialist risk analytics firm Zesty AI, says, "And if they don't trust their traditional models, then they are concerned that they will be losing money." He added, "Insurers are pulling out because nobody wants to be in the business of losing money." Zesty AI, whose customers include Farmers Insurance, reinsurer Berkshire Hathaway, and AON, uses artificial intelligence trained on more than 1,400 wildfire events to produce climate change risk scores for any individual property. In the same vein, reinsurance broker Willis Ray is using data from artificial intelligence firm Cloud to Street to help clients price flood reinsurance. Insurance statistics show an urgent need for such innovation. For example, according to Lloyd's of London insurer Chaucer, the average number of large US wildfires has risen by 30% over the past 15 years and by nearly a fifth in just the last 5 years. In all, data compiled by Swiss RE shows insured losses for so-called secondary perils such as floods and wildfires, rather than more closely modeled perils such as hurricanes, nearly doubled over the past decade. The reinsurer expects no let-up, forecasting a 30% to 63% rise in insured losses for all types of natural catastrophes in advanced markets by 2040. China, Britain, France, and Germany could even see those soaring between 90% and 120%. Given the momentum, Bruce Carnegie Brown, chairman of insurance market Lloyd's of London, told the Reuters news agency, "It is no surprise that traditional models cannot keep up." He said, "If you've reached an exponential part of the curve where suddenly something's accelerating, it's almost certain that we are underpricing the risk that we're taking." Policyholders are already feeling the heat, with insurance coverage getting costlier or harder to come by. Broker Marsh estimates U.S. property insurance rates have risen by 10% in the third quarter. In California, the state's insurance department's most recent data showed non-renewals of homeowners' insurance policies rose 31% from a year earlier in 2019 to more than 235,000. According to Carmen Balba, executive director of Consumer Watch LA, the data for 2020 could be similar. Across the northern border of California, the Insurance Bureau of Canada warned on its website homeowners might not be able to buy a new insurance policy if they have suffered a fire. Among those pulling back from home insurance in California are some household names, such as Liberty Mutual. Nationwide, and State Farm. Liberty Mutual said it was a difficult but necessary step to reduce overexposure to wildfires, a sentiment echoed by other insurers. Some insurers aim to reduce their exposure by helping clients become more resilient. For example, commercial insurer AXA offers a consulting service for clients such as manufacturers, identifying their vulnerabilities and suggesting remedies, such as erecting flood barriers. Its chief risk officer, Renaud Guidi, told Reuters news agency, "This is really an alignment of interest." Paul J. Crump, vice chairman of Chubb Group Global Underwriting and Claims, said, "U.S. insurer Chubb is also working with clients to help them make their infrastructure sturdier." Analysts say reinsurers, with their global scope and long history of underwriting catastrophe risks, also have a role to play in helping the industry adapt to climate change. Ernst Roach, chief climate and geoscientist at Munich Re, said the group had the expertise and willingness to take on climate risk. Ernst Roach said the 141-year-old company set up a team to work on natural catastrophes and climate change in the 1970s, after noticing loss patterns starting to change for weather-related events. He said, "We observed a continuation of years with losses significantly higher compared to the last 35 years or so, and that's reflected in our models. Yet there was a gap between what the reinsurer considered a fair premium and what insurers were prepared to pay." Ernst Raunch said, "We can only transfer this risk to our balance sheet if we get the premium which we need to cover these risks based on our own assessment." Ratings agency Standard & Poor's Global warned even reinsurers could be underestimating their exposure to climate risk by as much as 50%, describing their efforts to account for climate change as nascent in a recent report. Industry experts also say disasters such as hurricanes in Florida, with a long history of causing severe damage, are more closely modeled than floods or wildfires, which have only in recent years begun to cause major losses. That calls for reinsurers and independent risk modeling firms such as RMS and KCC to try new ways of approaching natural catastrophes. Laurent Mariscott, senior director EMEA and CIS at RMS, which sells its risk models to insurers, said one such approach is scenario modeling, where insurers are provided with a number of possible climate impacts on their portfolios over years to take account of the whole range of uncertainty. Laurent Mariscott said, for example, another involves machine learning, which can be used to take existing models of floods in a particular region and map them to other parts of the world. But any developments in making insurance more available and affordable will come too late for the Dunns. Tony Dunn said, "I was sad because we both spent our whole lives in California. We both grew up in San Diego." He added, "I never had any intention ever of leaving California."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen and Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much for inviting me to this program.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So today we want to talk about the 104th year in which marks the Balfour Declaration in Palestine. And, this Balfour Declaration, as the Palestinians calls it, has set the stage for the creation of the Israeli entity and the occupation of Palestine. Before getting to the issues that are taking place in Palestine today, let's get back to 1917, Said Murtaza. Explain a little bit about the Balfour Declaration itself.
Oh, thank you very much. You know, this declaration actually prepared a base for occupation by imperial powers during First World War. And, you know, behind this was the Zionist, actually, powers that were present in European countries, specifically talking in Great Britain.
That's
we had that strong presence. And this declaration was actually made to prepare, I would like to add a terminology, and that terminology was actually introduced for the first time through this declaration. It was a national home. Mm-hmm. And this declaration was very much stating the fact that Jews and Jewish people actually needed a place for settlement.
That's right.
And this declaration, for the first time, introduced a terminology, a term, for a Jewish people in order to have a home in Middle East. So that national home was introduced through this declaration. Unfortunately, later, the same term was very much explained and described as a vague one, mm-hmm. because nobody knew about two parts of this declaration, national home. So because Jews were not very much the most bigger population in Palestine.
That's right.
So unfortunately, declaration was for the first time defined in a wrong way. And then based on that wrong definition, future developments were made.
So there was only Palestine at that time and there was no Israel, isn't it?
Of course, no.
As a result of this declaration, you know, a country by the name of Israel was established.
Well, actually, you know, there was a kind of strategic imperial, you know, purpose and goal behind creating such a declaration. And Great Britain, especially the Zionist powers inside Great Britain, actually were behind this declaration.
Oh.
So it was actually made for in order to benefit only Zionists and those who were actually following this political ideology. So there was no benefit to the Jewish people, in fact, and it was only forcing Jews to move to Palestine and create a man-made, actually, a system. And that was actually the Zionist regime. And we know there was no name as Israel land at that time. So a declaration was only a paper in the first place. Later on, based on the same wrong paper, there were more developments made.
Okay, Said Mohsen, again, the role of Great Britain in establishing a legitimate authority in the Middle East, okay, we could see, you know, the power of the Britons in the other lands too, you know. They had their own ambassadors and embassies in different parts, also in Iran. They were active by supporting the Babis, you know, who wanted to create a kind of fake mysticism or power or something like that in Iran too. They were confronted, of course, by Amir Kabir on that time in Iran. But all in all, I could say that these colonial power had their role in establishing new lands because of their own purposes in the Middle East. What's your take on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we talk about the British government or the UK, we should bear in our minds that this is the cleverest government or the establishment in the whole world. Because of their hypocrisy, because of their, you know, having to face. And the main theme which they follow, through which they could rule over some parts of the world, including the Middle East and subcontinent. That theme, or we can say slogan, was divide and rule. Mm-hmm. So they try to divide the people of our place and then they rule over them. And that was the main reason of them having rulership over half of the world, we can say, or most of the countries. Now, this theme of divide and rule was applied on Palestinians as well. That's one side of the, that's one picture. We should look at the other side of a picture as well, that when we see the Holocaust happening and Hitler coming and killing all the Jews while saying that you will appraise me in future when you will know why I killed so many Jews, there was, we can say, like a harm or was a danger by the Jews to the existing, we can say, people or communities who were living in the Europe. Britain also never wanted to entertain Jews in their own country. You know, if Britain was at that time was thinking about the Jews and it wanted to give, you know, favor to the Jews, it should basically assign a specific land for the Jews.
That's right.
There is a big land over there. And if we can, we can see that they never did this, but rather what they did is they introduced this Balfour, we can say, like
declaration
in okay. which the statement was initially the statement was, if I can just read a couple of lines.
Okay.
It says His Majesty Government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
Now there is nothing about Zionist regime.
Oh.
It's the establishment as a national home for the Jewish people. Now, the question is, since when we have a home on the basis or the grounds of the religions? Is UK a homeland for Christians, Muslims, Jews? What is it? We don't have anything. So why they did this? Obviously, it shows us that they want to divide and rule on the basis of the religions. And this is what they are pursuing. Until now, we can see what happened in the subcontinent, you know, the Qadiani. There is a religion which was made and supported by the British government. The Wahhabism, Abdul Wahhab, he came up and he established his own government in the Hijaz in the name of Ali Saud, the Saudi tribe from the Najd. So we can see these things happening in the world, which was done by the British government.
The British and the British.
So it says that it was a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavor to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in the Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. The question is, when you made this declaration, today where are you? We can see the Zionist regime expanding their land.
Yes.
I would say these are the thugs who have occupied the land of Jews, Christians, and the Muslims in Palestine.
Yes, the Zionist, you mean.
The Zionist regime. I'm talking about the Zionist regime.
Yes.
Now, when in this declaration they say that they will not harm like the rights that they have, then why they are sleeping now?
Yes.
Why they are supporting them now? Why, when they're occupying the Palestinian lands and they're taking the lands and the homes, destroying the homes of the Palestinians at today's world, why they're not saying anything? Why they're silent on such an object? So it is clearly understood that the British government or the UK always, whenever they make a declaration, especially for the countries other than them, there is a specific benefit for them, and obviously they want to rule the world. They want to become the master of the whole world, and that's what they're pursuing for.
And we know that since then, so many catastrophes took place in Palestine. You know, mass killing of the people and children are taking place over there. And this year, 104 years have passed the Balfour Declaration, and still the Palestinians are suffering. Is it any way to get back to that declaration, Said Morteza, and delete it from history? And then Palestinians look after the rights for the lands or not?
Well, let's look at the other side of this declaration. One side, my brother mentioned, it was actually based on religious facts or religious elements. But actually what is happening on the ground these days is not based or according to any religious principles.
Mm-hmm.
So the political principles and ideologies is taking place all about this declaration. Long before, this declaration was described as a vague one. And these days, people are trying to provide a kind of close description of what was written there. Unfortunately, those lines that my brother just read have been misinterpreted from the first day.
That's right.
So from the political point of view, there are four reasons that so far have been calculated, and these reasons have been circulated even among mass medias. So the first one was that the Jews were actually massacred and prosecuted inside Europe. So they wanted to free these people.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just an excuse for British government to provide a kind of a safe homeland for
or
the
asylum.
Jews. They were looking actually for a protection for
That's
them.
Right.
So the second was actually controlling a very strong African country, and it was actually Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted actually to have a control over Egypt and Suez Canal. So they had the idea to control, to go and occupy Palestine in order to achieve that goal.
Okay.
The third reason was actually a kind of a strong lobby among British powerful figures and the Jews. When I say Jews, I don't mean actually the Jewish people, the Zionists, those who were actually the masterminds of creating such an ideology. And the third one actually was creating a government
this
as a puppet
one.
Yeah, that was the fourth. That was the
third one. Okay.
And the fourth one was actually creating a kind of puppet regime in the region in order to have the upper hand and control the countries in Middle East. So as you can see now, Palestine has been used by all superpower countries and is just, you know, creating some kind of problems for the neighboring countries around Palestine.
Right.
So we can see the political aspect was much more stronger than the religious.
So I
think that was a very strong reason. But if we go back and we plan to have something as a substitution or eradicate this declaration, so we have to go back and see the basics and the base for preparing such a declaration.
That's right.
Unfortunately, it happened around more than 104 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, most Middle East countries were some kind, you know, occupied by these imperial powers. And most Muslim countries were very much involved with their personal, you know,
That's
conflicts.
Right. Okay.
And I don't think we can go and create a kind of resistance to this declaration.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to go deeper and deeper into the layer of history and find some factors, influential factors that could have been actually used as a actually protection against issuing such a declaration.
That's all right.
By the points which brother just mentioned, 4 points, we can just take a result out of it that the Zionist regime are the servants of the British government.
This is so.
Who are who are working on the agenda of the, you know, British government in order to
So who is Balfour? Arthur Balfour was a British ambassador, isn't it? Yes,
whereas when they think like they have a they have a country for their own, like it is not the case. Basically, the America and the British is nowadays using them, and obviously they are the, you know, puppets.
Yeah, but the question is, why the international community is silent about, I mean, the crime of stealing Palestinian
land? Well, that's
land,
because of the system that we have in the world. For example, the capitalism is all over the world. And this system, obviously, it only talks about the investors and their benefit. The politicians who come, obviously, they also need some kind of, you know, investment.
That's right.
And they're also, we can say, like imprisoned under the system of the capitalism. Now, under the system, in the system of capitalism, we can see there were, you know, protests. Where was 99% against 1%? What was that? All those things. So most of these investors and those who have the companies who are running the politicians with their own money, most of them are the Jews.
That's right.
And they're related to the Zionist regime.
Of course, there are still some Jews who criticize the Balfour Declaration, too.
Yeah,
you
but
know?
These Jews are not the Zionists.
Zionist ones. That's what we have to distinguish between the Jews.
We do
and
this.
The
that's
Zionists.
What I said. Like the Zionist regime is basically doing that. So the main issue is why the most of the politicians' countries
that's
we
right.
have, the UNO, why they don't talk about it. It's because the finance is being provided by most of the Zionist regime, and obviously they are backing the governments. We can see clearly when there is a discussion in the parliament of, we can say, like the America or UK, they have these representatives over there who are representing.
Yes.
And obviously because
they
the
held their own conference
it's
in the
because
US, like,
the system is corrupted.
Oh.
So until this system of, like this system is not being changed, until that time, obviously, they are in the power.
That's all right.
Let's look at the issue profoundly, and we will find some really understandable reasons that why Palestine has been named as the occupied land.
Mm-hmm.
We had these occupiers moving all the way from Europe to Middle East and occupying this holy land.
That's right.
So for one very simple reasons, nothing happens unless you have somebody in power in the system.
That's right.
So there was a very strong lobbying group inside the British government, and they were actually lobbying with other communities in the British government because they themselves were believing in the Zionist ideology.
That's right.
So these people, these strong figures in the British government, made this declaration to be identified in the first place, to be interpreted differently, and they put this declaration into practice by themselves.
That's right.
So they brought these Jews just to the Holy Land in order to give them a kind of settlement. Mm-hmm. But that was not actually the whole story. The bigger picture was a different one. They wanted to create a regime based on their own benefits.
Yes.
And they did this at the price of other nations.
That's right.
So they now the occupied land is, the Palestine is the only land that does not belong only to Jews.
Yes.
We have Christians, Muslims, and even other nations.
Yes.
So Zionist regime is the one that has been brought by these imperials at that time. So I don't think Israel is going to stay there for long.
That's
and
right.
Their presence is not going to last long.
Inshallah, inshallah. Hope and the Palestine will be free one day, inshallah. And Palestine is for Palestinians. Thank you very much, Said Mohsen. And Said Murtaza for presence in the program Viewpoints, talking about Balfour Declaration. It was very kind of you. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Fraction and call it solution. Don't give me a prison and call it a
from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new analysis released recently shows the United States will ultimately spend upwards of $8 trillion and that nearly 1 million people have lost their lives so far in the so-called Global War on Terror that was launched after the attacks of September 11, 2001. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by John Quilly, journalist. This article is published under the heading Estimated cost of post 9/11 US wars hits $8 trillion with nearly a million people dead. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. With the final U.S. troops leaving Afghanistan after nearly 20 years of occupation and war, a new analysis released recently shows the United States will ultimately spend upwards of $8 trillion. And that, nearly 1 million people have lost their lives so far in the so-called Global War on Terror that was launched after the attacks of September 11, 21. What about the people left behind in Afghanistan, in Iraq, after a drone strike in Somalia? What about them? Do they get any care? Do they get any compensation? Absolutely not. So what would be the cost of war if that was actually the priority for the United States? Dr. Maha Helal, Justice for Muslim Collective, said. According to Brown University's Cost of War Project, which has been releasing reports on the financial and human costs of the post-9/11 wars at regular intervals since 2010, the total cost of the war and military operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, and elsewhere over the last 2 decades have directly killed at least 897,000 to 929,000 people. An estimate, the researchers say, is conservative. Dr. Nita Crawford, co-director of the Cost of War Project, in a statement said, "The deaths we tallied are likely a vast undercount of the true toll these wars have taken on human life. It's critical we properly account for the vast and varied consequences of the many U.S. wars and counter-terror operations since 9/11, as we pause and reflect on all of the lives lost." The study calculates that of the $8 trillion estimated cost in the wars waged by the United States regime since 9/11, $2.3 trillion is attributed to the Afghanistan-Pakistan war zone, $2.1 trillion is attributed to the Iraq-Syria war zone, and $355 billion was attributed to other battlefields, including Libya, Somalia, and elsewhere. Above those figures, another $1.1 trillion was spent on homeland security programs, and $2.2 trillion is the estimated obligation for the future care of U.S. veterans who served in the various wars. Detailing the report for The Intercept, journalist Murtaza Hussein writes, "The staggering economic cost of the war on terror pale in comparison to the direct human impact measured in people killed, wounded, and driven from their homes. The Cost of War Project's latest estimates hold that 897,000 to 929,000 people have been killed during the wars. Of those killed, 387,000 are categorized as civilians, 207,000 as members of national military and police forces, and a further 301,000 as opposition fighters killed by U.S.-led coalition troops and their allies. The report also found that around 15,000 U.S. military service members and contractors have been killed in the wars, along with a similar number of allied Western troops deployed to the conflicts and several hundred journalists and humanitarian aid workers. The question of how many people have lost their lives in the post-9/11 conflicts has been the subject of ongoing debate, though the numbers in all cases have been extraordinarily high." Previous cost of war studies have put death toll figures in the hundreds of thousands, an estimate tallying those directly killed by violence. According to a 2015 estimate from the Nobel Prize-winning Physicians for Social Responsibility, well over 1 million have been killed both indirectly and directly in the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan alone. The difficulty of calculating death tolls is made harder by the U.S. military's own refusal to keep track of the number of people killed in its operations, as well as the remoteness of the regions where many of the conflicts take place. The researchers behind the project emphasize that while the total number of direct deaths caused by the more recent wars are less than the World Wars and the Vietnam War, the post-9/11 conflicts are different because of the long-term damage they have done to the societies and have suffered under many years of constant bombings, death, and destruction. Dr. Stephanie Sable, co-director of the project, said in a statement, "What have we truly accomplished in 20 years of post-9/11 wars and at what price? 20 years from now, we will still be reckoning with the high societal cost of the Afghanistan and Iraq wars long after U.S. forces are gone." The Cost of War Projects report arrived on the same day as a similar study unveiled by the National Priorities Project, which showed that overall spending on increased militarization both abroad and domestically in the U.S. has soared since 9/11. In that study, as Common Dreams reports separately, overall spending on increased military operations, domestic surveillance, border security is estimated at $21 trillion. An online event with the report's lead researcher, Dr. Nita Crawford, and other experts to discuss the findings of the report was held recently. Hosted by The Intercept Hussein, the panel also featured Dr. Catherine Lutz and Dr. Linda Bones of the Cost of War Project and Dr. Maha Halal of the Justice for Muslims Collective. In addition, remarks will be made by Senator Jack Reed and Representatives Barbara Lee, David Cicilline, and Ro Khanna. Speaking during the panel discussion, Dr. Halal said that the money on war spent since 9/11 is, to her, $8 trillion dedicated to the murder of Muslims, and I see no better way to make this sound any better or different. We talk about what will happen to the veterans when they come back, she continued. Obviously, that's important to address, but what about the people left behind in Afghanistan, in Iraq, after a drone strike in Somalia? What about them? Do they get any care? Do they get any compensation? Absolutely not. So what would be the cost of war if that was actually the priority for the United States? In conclusion to her remarks, Halal quoted from the 2013 testimony of a 13-year-old boy from Pakistan named Zabir, whose family had been targeted by U.S. drones, when he told Congress, "I no longer love blue skies. In fact, I now prefer gray skies. The drones do not fly when the skies are gray." This is the cost of war, Halal said. That a young boy 13 years old can never look at the sky the same way that people who haven't been bombarded with violence can. And this, to me, is one of the things that has been totally neglected.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.